Welcome to Sleeping Through Class. I'm Brendan Warho. I'm here with Kevin Beato and Nicholas Rishkevitz. Today we're picking up in our series looking at revolutions. We are going to discuss the Mexican Revolution along with the Bolivar Revolutions as we look at Latin America. So, we are following the Haitian Revolution and the French and American Revolutions. Kevin, tell us a little bit about the stage for these revolutions. What was life like in the Spanish colonies?
Yeah, so Spain and Portugal control essentially everything from Mexico on down to the tip of Chile and Argentina. So a large portion of the Americas is controlled by Spain and Portugal. Now, in the late 1700s, you have the American Revolution. The Spanish are going to send a ton of money to the Americas to help kick the British. So, essentially, these major powers, the Spanish, the British, the French, they all like to take their shots at each other when they can, and the American Revolution gave France and Spain an opportunity to do that at Great Britain, which cost Spain a lot of money. Now, they're going to rely on these massive colonies in the Americas to help fund this. So, their economy starts to tank, they increase taxes in the Latin American colonies. Now, they also realize that they need to be able to generate money. So they end up also helping to build up the infrastructure in Latin America. What this does is now it educates the people in Latin America. So now they're getting these Enlightenment ideas through their new educational institutions. In terms of their social status and, you know, social structure, there's multiple different groups of people. The peninsulares are the people who are from Spain. Peninsulares coming from peninsula, the Iberian Peninsula, which is where Spain and Portugal are from. And then you also have these Creoles who are below the peninsulares, but they're people who were born in the colonies but are of Spanish descent. And then you have all these mixed races that also go underneath that.
So we're looking at this strange sort of situation, right? It's 1807. Napoleon has invaded and conquered the Iberian Peninsula. So Spain and Portugal are captured. So revolutionaries in Latin America look and they see this moment and they say, oh my God, the king of Portugal and the king of Spain are basically handicapped right now. And if we want freedom, now's the time. Now's the time to strike. So Nick, can you tell me a little bit about what happens in Mexico after the Iberian Peninsula is conquered by Napoleon?
Sure. Mexico has an interesting story. So, obviously, we know that Spain is having their own problems back in Spain with the French conquering their territory. And Father Hidalgo wants to bring about change. Father Hidalgo is known as the father of Mexican independence. And he wants to bring about change in Mexico. Now, Mexico had been under this social system based off the encomienda system put in place by the Spanish. And it put, as we mentioned before, the peninsulares, people born in Spain, in power in Mexico. And then under that, you know, it was sort of the social system that was primarily based on your race and the location of your birth. And he wanted to bring about an end to this social system, as he felt that, you know, it was unjust. So, you know, he originally intends to do that, but due to fear by Spanish authorities who sort of feared his ability to organize the people in his community and within Mexico to, you know, bring about this change to the social structure that was happening there. He ends up being sort of seized by Spanish authorities and then ultimately executed by them. His ideas, though, and his push to bring about this change, to get rid of the social structure that had been in place, which put Spanish people at the top of society, kind of carried over, and that's why he's able to get that title, the father of Mexican independence. So after his death, another Mexican revolutionary named José María Morelos organized a Congress, sort of like the American Continental Congress that had developed in the American colonies before the American Revolution. He pushed for certain rights, things like all people born in Mexico to be given the same legal status, right? That was something that was not the case under the Spanish system. People who were born in Spain or who were, you know, of Spanish parents, they were given special protections and special treatment under the law. So he wanted to see legal status become equal for all people born into Mexico, and he wanted all people born in Mexico to have similar freedoms to what we see in the American Bill of Rights, certain guaranteed freedoms that they would have that would be protected, that wouldn't be taken away by the government. Morelos, as well, was captured and also executed by the Spanish.
So we see there's these Enlightenment ideas that keep popping up, right? They popped up in the French Revolution, the American Revolution, the Haitian Revolution. And now we're sort of looking at this mess in Mexico. You know, Spain is trying to control Mexico, but they really can't. And even though they keep catching and executing the leaders of the Mexican independence movement, it's not going to stop. And so they're starting to realize that they have to do something. There has to be some sort of compromise. You know, unlike how the British tried to go into America and conquer them, the Spanish don't have the resources to even really fight this war. Nick, what did the Spanish and the Mexicans finally decide to do?
Yeah, so as you said, right, these ideas aren't just going to go away. They're not just going to die out. These Enlightenment ideas, you can see from our earlier unit where we covered these ideas, they've spread. They've spread to the Americas. They've spread to North America and the new United States. They've spread in Europe and places like France. They've also spread into Central and South America as well. So Spain, realizing that, you know, this is becoming a complete mess, comes to a compromise with Mexico that includes three parts. So one, Mexico would officially become independent from Spain, so it would no longer be a Spanish territory, but they would have their own monarchy, so a Mexican king and queen to rule, or an emperor to rule. Creoles and peninsulares would be given equal rights in Mexico, so that is sort of what this whole movement started with. They sort of achieved that goal of everybody in Mexican society being given equal rights under the law. And then the last is that the Catholic Church would become the official church of Mexico. So it would be the official religion in Mexico, Catholicism, which would sort of keep and, I guess, maintain that connection to Spain, which was a Catholic country at the time. Spain and Mexico agreed to these terms, and it eased the tension between the social classes in Mexico. So Spain and Mexico agreed to those terms, and thus it ended up easing tensions between the social classes in Mexico and also between the people pushing for the revolution within Mexico and the Spanish. As a result, eventually a Creole royalist military officer would rise to power, and Mexico would get its first emperor, Emperor Augustine I of Mexico.
Fantastic. So one of the things that's kind of almost embarrassing to mention is, like, when I was in school, I didn't ever really learn about Simón Bolívar. Like, I had heard the name. I knew Bolivia was a country. And if you had asked me who he was, I would have said a guy in Central American, Latin American history. But I really don't know much about him. And it wasn't until I became a social studies teacher that I started to actually be like, okay, I have to know who this guy is and what the background is. So, Kevin, can you give me just the basics on, like, who Simón Bolívar is?
Yeah, so Simón Bolívar, his main nickname is El Libertador, which is translated to the Liberator, and you'll see why very quickly. He was born into wealth in Venezuela, and at the age of 16, he's sent over to Europe to further his education. He goes to Spain, and when he goes to Paris, he falls in love with France and the Enlightenment ideals, and he sees Napoleon Bonaparte as just the embodiment of the Enlightenment. That is until the coronation of Napoleon, and he realizes that he's just a dictator. And when he's in Italy, furthering his education even still, he's reading on these Enlightenment ideals, and there he determines that he's going to set his people free, essentially, in South America. His whole idea is to create sort of a unified state in Latin America, unify the people against the peninsulares and against the Spanish and Portuguese, essentially. So he goes back and he helps to free the Venezuelans from foreign rule. He goes into Colombia, does the same thing. He's doing so by rallying the base and even turning a lot of people that would have fought for the Spanish, helping them fight for the Latin Americans. He continues this trend from Venezuela and Colombia into Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia. His dream is to create this new country that he would call the Federation of the Andes, because that is the great mountain chain that goes up the western stretch of South America.
So we see Simon Bolivar, and he starts to, you know, help liberate these countries. But was he the only person that was in South America trying to do anything? Like, why did he have to, like, put the team on his back, or were there other people there?
No, he did not have to do it all himself. There is another big name in Latin American history, and especially South American history. José de San Martín was a person from Argentina who helped. He fought for Spain in the Napoleonic Wars, actually, but then he turned on them when he came back, and he helped them create or win independence from the Spanish. And Argentina ends up winning independence in 1816, and he goes to Chile to help with the revolution there. So it's not just Simón Bolívar who's the chief liberator there. He does have some help. José de San Martín helps with Argentina and Chile as well.
So we have José San Martín, José de San Martín, excuse me, and Simón Bolívar, and they're leading these revolutions. Bolívar is up in the northern part, and then eventually in the western part of South America, and you have José de San Martín in the southeastern part, like Argentina. What's going on with the largest country in Latin America, or what's going on with the largest country in South America, Brazil? Kevin, can you tell me just a little bit about what's going on there?
Yeah, so when Napoleon goes into the Iberian Peninsula, the monarchy of Portugal flees and they go to Brazil. That's their main piece of the puzzle there in South America. And now it's the largest country in South America, and also a very successful soccer team. They end up liking it a lot, but then once Napoleon gets kicked out, you know, the Portuguese, they want their monarchy back. You know, if you're going to rule us, you should do it here. So they leave, but their son, Pedro, is left in Brazil, and he's the one who's going to end up sort of getting independence for Brazil and ruling Brazil.
So it's famous for being the bloodless revolution because, unlike these other revolutions where people were killing each other, you know, the American, the French, the Haitian, and many in Central and South America, you have this revolution where essentially because the royal family is the same, Brazil, which is gigantic, was able to free itself from Portugal, this little country in Europe, and they were able to do that without having to fight a war, which is kind of crazy. One of the facts that I love to tell my students more than anything else is that there are more people who speak Portuguese outside of Portugal than in Portugal. And I think the same is true with English too, right? So kind of mind-blowing. So the connections, right? When we look at all these revolutions, they're all caused by the same kind of things. Now, if I was a DBQ writer, or if I was writing a Regents exam or a NCFE or something like that, I would say, you know, draw the connections between these revolutions. You know, let's look at the French Revolution, the American Revolution, the Haitian Revolution, Bolivar's revolutions, and what connections can be drawn between them.
Well, obviously, the biggest connection is the connection that goes back to the Enlightenment. It's these ideas of, you know, a government having certain responsibilities to the people, and people having certain freedoms, and you know, all of that kind of is the motivating and driving factor behind this. It's sort of a move away from the era of dominating kings ruling over their territory and running things how they wanted without any repercussions. So that's sort of the big idea there. But when we look at especially these other revolutions here, a lot of it deals with you know, social classes and stuff like that. You know, we see that in the French Revolution with the three estates. We see that in the Latin American revolutions with the encomienda system and the unfairness between the different different groups of people. They're the Creoles and the Peninsulares, for example. So yeah, that's what I would say is one of the big connectors there, that this is not just about the Enlightenment ideals, but also about maybe more equality and fairness under the law, as opposed to a ruling class that gets far better treatment than a poorer class in society.
Thank you, Nick. So as we look forward in history, we're at the early 1800s when most of these revolutions are taking place. And the 1800s is a hugely pivotal moment in world history, particularly because this is the time when the Industrial Revolution gets going. It begins in England and starts to work its way towards the Americas. And this story is sort of just a life-changing, world-changing sort of thing. We start to see suddenly machines are being used for all kinds of different work. In our next episode, Kevin, Nick, and I are going to discuss how the Industrial Revolution permanently changed the world. For Kevin, for Nick, and for myself, thank you for joining us. And this is Sleeping Through Class.